Hey, Empire Builders, I have such an exciting opportunity for you. If you are in or around Las Vegas on Tuesday, February 18th, I need you to mark your calendar because at the Mandalay Bay Convention Center, we are going to be hosting a live Empire Building session at 3:15. And right afterwards, we're actually going to be doing an in-person mastermind where we are working on your businesses together. So if you want to come and join us, please go and RSVP for your free seat at herbestlife.com/events. That's herbestlife.com/events. Hope to see you there.
Welcome to Empire Building. I'm Wendy Papazan, and together with my four co-hosts, we bring you weekly unfiltered conversations about leadership, growing a big empire, and living on your own terms.
I'm Kimber Lovett-Minkiti. We are investors and wealth builders with over $75 million in combined net worth.
I'm Sarah Reynolds. We are visionaries who built more than 50 businesses with over $122 million in annual revenue.
I'm Tiffany Fikes. We've led thousands of people and do it all while being pretty good moms.
And I'm Seychelle Van Poole. We are your podcast to learn how to build big businesses and even bigger lives.
Hi, everybody. You have Tiffany and Kimber with you this week, and we have the absolute pleasure of introducing you to one of our favorite people, Becky Lowrance, who is an amazing female business owner, business buyer. She's not transitioned. I'm not going to say transitioned. She started out selling real estate and she still does that some, but she's also discovered a passion of buying businesses and launching businesses as well. So I am super excited to have you with us, Becky, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
And I'm going to give you guys just a tip. Becky, we had a chance. Tiffany connected us at our big Her Best Life event, which is one of our big signature events of the business Tiffany and I co-own together. And so I had a chance to interview Becky at this event, actually just a couple months ago, about that journey that you've been on. And I had women coming up to me for the rest of the time being like, that was so inspirational. It was so powerful. You have a very tactical way that you've been able to transition right from both, like Tiffany's like, wrong word, right? But just take a real estate business, which you then understand really well, and then start investing and buying all different types of businesses. So we're excited to like unpack that. And if you weren't with us in Miami, bring a little bit of that journey to you guys today.
Thank you. Yeah, that's awesome. I really appreciate you guys having me on. I think you're right in the fact that, you know, it's easy to use the word transition. I'm still actively doing real estate. I would say that it's just my focus and my priorities have shifted a little bit. And so I am here to service my existing clients. I still get a few referrals that come in. I've just really streamlined what I want my business to look like. And I feel like for almost a decade, I've just kind of taken everything but the kitchen sink, you know, as a real estate agent. So like anybody who calls, the answer is always yes. And pivoting to focusing on business acquisitions has actually in some ways improved my real estate business because it's made me more selective in what I'm willing to do or who I'm willing to work with. I work with a coach in building out a client avatar as far as like every time we say yes to something, we're saying no to something else. And I didn't realize how much not all business is good business. And so just discovering that, I really kind of sometimes look back on myself with a little bit of judgment that I'm like, man, 10 years in, I should have been a little more clear about what good business actually looked like. But I didn't have the maturity to do that. I think I kind of approached with a scarcity mindset that I'm just like, I got to take everything that comes. And now I'm starting to realize that doing everything and catching everything and saying yes to everything is not necessarily the highest and best use of my time. And I've really gotten to a point through, especially through business acquisitions, of realizing that for the most part, my time is much more valuable pursuing more businesses to buy than it is trying to solicit more buyers and sellers. And so again, I'm still servicing my existing people. I do 25 to 30 deals a year as a solo agent, and I would really like to see that next year be more like 8 or 10. And so, you know, still staying in it enough. It's too valuable. I really do feel like my license is too valuable to completely get out of it. But yes, I have transitioned into business acquisitions. It's something that about 4 years ago, my husband and I came upon the opportunity. We had sold a large grading and excavating company, and didn't really know what the next steps were. And sometimes that can be kind of scary, but we just, it's weird to have a firm sense of knowing you're not supposed to be somewhere while not knowing what the next steps are going to be. So it was just an experience of like, okay, we're going to go kind of jump off the cliff because this is what we feel like we're being asked to do. But at the same point, not knowing, okay, where's the safety net? And so we kind of had, it's hard. You go back and it's like these times that were probably 4 months felt more like 4 years. But there was a transition period between leaving that company and in discovering an opportunity to buy an existing business. And in that time and space, we didn't know when we sold the company that we're like, oh, we're going to get into doing this thing. But we just were in a period of growing and learning. And at this point, I would have been 37. My husband would have been 40. We spent a lot of time just like on the front porch with a piece of paper and a pen trying to figure out like, what are our family values? Like, what is it that we want the next half of our life to look like? And we want to be so intentional with this. And because of selling a decent sized company, like we didn't have the financial pressure necessarily to say, hey, we've got to go, you know, really immediately start making money again. So we had a little bit of breathing space, which looking back was such a gift, but it did not feel like a gift in the moment. Just because it's hard to venture out when you don't know what you're doing. And we felt really unmoored and unsettled. And so it was a tough time. But I feel like most of the pivotal moments in my life, I can look back and find a lot of similarities there that was like, man, there was always a leap of faith. There was always kind of bumping around in the dark.
Well, I think that's such an important thing. That feeling of unmooredness, like you said. Tell us, like, okay, you were selling real estate very, very successfully. I mean, selling 30 to 40 homes as a solo agent, that's amazing. To, okay, you find yourself in this other business and then you find yourself on the porch trying to figure it all out. Like, tell us the story of that.
Sure. You know, it was a family-owned business and it was, you know, kind of taking something from very, very small company and then really not having a playbook. And taking something to several million dollars and having a tremendous amount of success over that. But there's not a guide, really, to just like, here, this is how you build a business. Step one, two, three, four, you know? And so it's like all the way around walking into an industry that we didn't know anything about. And, you know, in fairness, you know, my husband did so much of the grunt work, if I'm looking at the two of us as a pair, like that was primarily his thing. But taking something that he didn't know anything about, that he wasn't particularly passionate about, but knowing that he's got a superpower of scaling and just helping things grow. And also being able to dismantle a lot of confusing bits into like, what's the essence of what we're doing here? Steve Jobs says you can't scale things that aren't simple. John has a unique ability of being able to go in and just see the simplicity in, you know, we'll buy a business that's got 17 checking accounts and he can come in and just quickly be like, okay, these are the three that we need to keep and the rest of it needs to go. He's also very, very good at making steadfast decisions and he's not a bully, but he also just doesn't live in the world with constantly having these feelers out as to what everybody is thinking or feeling about him. So it keeps him focused with the ability to just make really clear-cut decisions. And of course, he realizes the importance of like bringing people on board. But it was a decision at the time that he was like, this is what's right. This is what I feel like I'm supposed to do. And so it was something we had talked about for a while. It's tricky because it is family and those relationships. And it was a really, really tough transition. It was the hardest thing I've ever gone through in my entire life.
Why did you buy this? Why did you buy this business you knew nothing about?
Yeah. At the time, my husband was a W-2 and he and this family member that we were in business with were best friends. And it just got to the point that John wanted to he had built houses for years. So he had had experience in being self-employed, but he was in this learning phase. He's one of these guys who like has a business degree, but he's always been really passionate in blue collar trades. And so he had worked in HVAC, he had built houses, he had just not done grading and excavating. So it wasn't like the construction space was completely foreign to him, but he had an opportunity to buy in and say, hey, this is a pathway for you to get back into self-employment. And the family member is like, I want to grow this. And I've been able to start it and kind of keep it. I think it had been a business for like 10 years, but it was just a handful of people. And he was like, I don't think that I have the skill set to get it to the next level. I've got the relationships. And I think it's a very different person who can scale a company to maybe like $1 million mark and then take something from $1 million to maybe 10. I think that that's a different skill set. And that's not to say that same person can't grow into that. But uniquely, I think that my husband would have struggled to start something from scratch. And I think that this family member would have struggled to necessarily build to the scale where we left it. And so you just found two guys that were really well suited to bring their talents together and said, hey, we're going to figure this out. And that's exactly what we did. And it was awesome. While it was really awesome, but it just got to the point that it was like not what we were supposed to be doing anymore. And I really look back from even a spiritual perspective that I think that God placed in both of their hearts a holy unrest. That was just like, I know that you guys are like thinking this is the end of forever and this is all you're ever going to do. And you watch two men with absolute incredible integrity and character that tried their very best to stick it out and put it together and go to counseling and do all the things. And there was just this spirit that just could not be shaken. And now, you know, they always say life is so clear when you drive in reverse. And you're so able to go back and be like, oh, well, that made sense because of this and this and this. And now we have the clarity 4 years out from that to say, like, it makes more sense now. But in the moment, you know, unfortunately, we have to live in fast forward, you know, and it didn't always make sense along the way. I think that all of us now, given the 4 years between where we were then and where we're at now, everybody has excelled and succeeded in the roles that they're currently in. And it's still bittersweet to look back and just say, like, man, there's a little bit of what could have been, but at the same point, knowing that both families are on such wonderful trajectories with what we're doing today, it's still like, I think there's a part of us that still all grieves the fact that we're not doing this together, but there's just change happens. And sometimes change, you know, it does invite suffering to an extent, but you learn through that. And, yeah. And, you know, nobody's business blew up because of it. You know, the grading and excavating company has, I would say, probably doubled since we've left. Like, they've just taken it and run with it. And I can celebrate their success and be so happy for them. Most of my family works there, so it's cool. Yeah. And then with what we've been able to do, what we found is that whenever we were in the grading and excavating business, my husband was working there 40, 50, 60 hours a week. Because that was his philosophy as a business owner, that I've got to be in the weeds with this thing. He didn't understand the concept of owning a business that you don't actively manage. And when we had that transition of sitting on the front porch and getting really clear about our priorities, I had much more flexibility in my schedule as a real estate agent. So there was a lot of just last minute trips that I ended up taking with our three sons where my husband didn't go, because he had to be in the office or he had to be on a job site. And so that was one of the things when we were sitting there, he was like, priority number one, my family's never going on vacation without me again. Like that, he was like, I don't love that. I don't want that to be the narrative of my kids' lives, that dad was too busy doing other things. So we knew that we couldn't be tied to a location. And I love to travel, so the idea of that really excited me. And so we kind of came to this conclusion that there's this concept of freedom, and a lot of business owners who are successful have the freedom of money, but they don't have the freedom of time. And a lot of people who have the freedom of time don't have the freedom of money, because it's like, oh man, I'm not busy. I need to be working. And so we just said, you know, what would it look like to start a company that is literally like based around this concept of freedom? How do we help people find freedom of time and freedom of money? That's what we want as business owners. And is there a way that we can help other entrepreneurs find that as well?
Yeah, I love that you talk about being at like that porch moment, right? Of like the clarity to like set your values of what was going to be important for you all. So that when that like first opportunity, which I'd love for you to unpack for us, comes, you actually have the filter by which to look at it and decide like, okay, how do we determine not only of like, can we do the business part of acquisition, but is it in alignment with the values that we've set out?
I think it's so important to actually have your values written down. There is an integrity piece that comes into having something in writing that you have to come back to and serve as kind of a filter through which you make decisions. And it's really easy to get excited about an opportunity that comes your way and get kind of loosey-goosey with your own moral compass. And this is one of the things that I learned from the keynote speaker that we had at Her Best Life, talking about like this internal integrity with like, it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. This is not even a matter of like morality as far as right or wrong. There are a set of principles and standards that I'm choosing to live by for my family, for our values, and to not compromise on those things. And guys, let me tell you, there's compromise that hits me 15 times a day. Opportunities come up that I could get real passionate about. I could get real excited about, and I could be like, oh, I see it. Like, this would be so cool to be involved in. And then I keep having to go back to our written list of being like, but wait a minute, that violates point number three. This violates point number two. And that's not to say also, I think it's okay. John and I, if there's one adage or one principle that we carry in our family, is that we reserve the right to change our minds.
100%.
And so it is okay to say, hey, as a family, these values or these principles or these guiding things no longer serve us. They become more of a master than a servant. These are no longer serving us. We are now going to collectively sit down and say, do we need to reevaluate some things? And I do think that that's important. One of the things we've reevaluated on is that we had written down on that piece of paper that we would never have any employees. We now have 80 employees. So we have definitely compromised on that one. And we kind of, after, you know, working through that, came to the point that that was more or less coming from a place of hurt and frustration of what we had just left of just, man. And to be honest with you, I don't want to ever paint a rosy picture that like entrepreneurship is like being a business owner is the hardest thing you will ever do. I think there's a lot of benefit to it. I would much rather have the opportunities. I like having a lot of agency and control. I would rather be a business owner any day of the week than working for somebody else, but it's tough. And one of the hardest things that you deal with as being a business owner is working with people. And, you know, they ask me all the time, well, how do you know if you find the right partner or what about employees? What if whenever you buy a business, what if half of the staff leaves? Like, all of those are really great questions. But if working with people is going to be the determining factor as far as like either you're willing to take on all it entails or you're not, there's a quote that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, you've got to take other people with you. And now I see the benefit in a way that I didn't necessarily when we were really in the weeds with it. There's no way I could own 7 companies and be doing the things that we're doing today without the help and support of so many other people that are working towards a common goal and common effort. And then I also see it differently in the fact that we're supporting 80 households, you know, and that is a stewardship thing that feels really cool to me, that kind of changes the paradigm between, oh, I've just got to deal with these complicated humans, to a stewardship and a servant leadership of like, look what we get to provide for them. I get to provide a safe environment for people to work. I get to provide good company culture. I get to pay people well. And that kind of helped me take it from kind of a negative bent to like, this is a privilege instead of this is a problem.
Walk us through, I mean, 7 businesses. Today, you own 7 additional businesses that you have bought into. So like, I'm sure the first few, you learn a lot of lessons. So walk us through kind of that process that you go through when that business opportunity gets presented, like one of those 7, kind of a mini case study, if you will.
So I will say that out of the 7, we're actually closing on an HVAC company this week. So that'll be 8. 2 of those were not any companies that we bought into. They were kind of startups. So I just want to clarify, I have not bought 7 businesses. I do have ownership in 7.
You've only bought 5. I'm sorry. You've only bought five.
I'm always one of these people that's like, one day as this thing progresses, like if we ever write a book or something, I just don't want somebody coming back and being like, I saw that podcast and she was a fraud. You know, so it's like, I'm always very careful that like, I just want to be accurate. But yeah, so the first company that we entertained buying was actually the second company that we bought. But I'll just use that as a case study. We bought a large commercial roofing company here in Nashville, and it had been in business since 1981. I think at that point, I'm going to ballpark this and say it had around 30 employees. The owner wanted to retire. His kids didn't want the business. He had been really successful, and our CPA brought us that deal. So when we think about, for anybody who's interested in kind of exploring this, what does it look like to go and buy a business? Your professional network is who you need to be networking with. When we're real estate agents, you kind of put on the hat, like, I need to go to all the social events. Somebody invites me to a baby shower or a birthday party. Like, I've got to go to all the things. I think whenever you put on the goggles of, like, I'm looking for a business to buy, it is much more about professional networking. So it's your CPAs, your bankers, your insurance agents, kind of more of like your B&I type groups.
Attorneys,
yeah. And so these are going to be the people who, like, along the way, they're likely going to be the first people who catch a wind that somebody may be thinking about selling their business. Think of a CPA, right? They're doing their taxes and they're just having these conversations that's like, man, I think I'm going to start sunsetting this thing. I don't know how much longer I want to be doing this. You know, I had that heart attack last year. Like, my health's not great. And so those are the kind of the ding, ding, dings that people are listening for when it comes time to saying, like, oh, I actually know somebody. This is what our CPA said to this guy. I actually know somebody. I've got a good friend of mine who is in the market to buy a business just like yours. You know, would you have any interest in connecting the two of you and just having a conversation? And the fact that, like, our CPA is somebody that my husband went to college with, like, he had a long-standing relationship there. So it wasn't just this, like, I kind of sort of know him. He's like, no, like, I really know this guy. I've known him for 20 years. Like, he's a solid dude. And, you know, it may not make sense, but I don't think it would necessarily hurt you to have a conversation. And having that vouched for from somebody that is that mutual trust relationship, you know, he'd done this guy's taxes for years. So he already had the seller's trust. And then by extension, so did we, because then our CPA said, I trust them. And so those are really valuable relationships to have. So he said, you know, I could connect the two of you. So he ended up reaching out to us and saying, hey, I know you guys are looking for a business. I have a client. We ended up getting connected and we were so excited. You know, it's like your first deal. We all know what, you know, real estate, the very first listing you ever got, we'll never forget that, right? The excitement. And my husband and I went to breakfast with he and his wife and just kind of built some rapport and he'd heard more about their story. And we were really excited about it. And then kind of in halfway through our due diligence process, there was another bell at the ball. There was a private equity firm that came in and decided that they wanted to buy the company and they were offering them way more than what we could. And it was just really like a kick in the teeth that we're like, man, these numbers don't make sense. Like, how in the world are they offering so much more? We've done, you know, but it's like also we didn't really know what we were doing. You know, we were familiar with P&Ls and stuff, but it's like we were also building the plane as we were flying it. So then we're like, are we making a mistake? Is it really worth more? And what actually ended up happening is that company in the 11th hour failed to close on it. And I think it is because they finally realized that they were overpaying for something. And then the seller came back to us and said, you know, hey, they've walked, you know, and it was honestly a better transaction for us because he had already been through it with kind of the big corporate, you know, national buyers. And we were just like this younger couple that just lived in the same city. And we were just trying to do this for the first time, you know. And so the spirit of cooperation was really strong. And we still, 4 years later, still have a great relationship with the seller. He'll just walk into the office randomly sometimes. And we love having him there. Most of the employees that worked for him are still a part of the organization. And for him to be able to see how happy they are and how well taken care of they are, the fact they're making more money than even when he was there, I think that there's just, it's his legacy that is continuing. And we don't take that lightly. And the fact that, you know, we bought it 4 years ago, which would have been 2020. He had been in business since 1981. Y'all, we're standing on the shoulders of so much. I know what it is to start a business, you know, or to even be in the early stages of it. You know, when we had the grading and excavating company, I mean, there's times when you're in the very early parts of it. Thank God I had real estate. There were months we went and didn't get paid.
Yeah.
You know, and I look at that, I'm like, no doubt he experienced these same things in this growth phase. And for us to be able to stand on the shoulders of all of that hard work, it's an honoring thing to just be able to say, man, this is his legacy. And the fact that it's still in existence today and we're still putting roofs on all over, you know, the area is a reflection of him as much as it's anything that we're doing. And that's something that's kind of precious to me.
Becky, I just want to highlight like three of the things that you said that I think are really important for our empire builders that are listening. Like one, like you started with relationships, right? Like once you decided to do this, you looked at your professional relationships that could be that source, right? Like who do we know and trust, letting them know that we have this interest and then having them kind of help make those connections. And then when you even sat down for the first time with the sellers, you didn't like say, oh yeah, just send me all your, don't like take a very transactional view. You took that same relational thread. So the first thing you did was actually sit down, go to breakfast, talk about them, right? Get to know who they were as people, which I think is such a powerful thing. I think sometimes we just go right into like, yeah, send me the due diligence package. No, you actually were like, nope, we used a strong relationship. We started with that relationship. And then I think the third thing you said was like, you knew your buy box, even at your first one. I think so often people like, right, you get another buyer, the competitive nature of it takes over, and then people violate the numbers, right? And you guys were like, well, maybe we did miss something, but like, here's our math. We're not going to eliminate what we know to be how we could run it, even if that means we're going to lose the deal. And I think we see a lot of people like who violate that, and they just get into like wanting to win. And so the buy box and the performa and the numbers, like they violate it. And then like, right. So I think those were such like, you described it so well, but I want to make sure everyone heard those three things on the front end before you ever start to then like, right, build on top of that powerful culture and legacy that the prior owner had.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to even what we talked about earlier about writing these things down, because it keeps you accountable and it keeps the emotions out of it when you go and you're like, but it's our first deal and who knows when we'll have another opportunity like this, and they are making money and we could still buy it at that price and still make a little bit of money. Maybe we could, you know, I find that the hardest part is I coach a lot of people who are looking to buy businesses, and I feel like the biggest thing is that people can get real caught up in buying hopes and dreams. And if you're gonna buy hopes and dreams, you might as well just make them your own hopes and dreams instead of piggybacking off of somebody else and paying a premium for it. You know, that so many times people are looking to buy businesses and they're really more of like, you're kind of just buying a job, or you're buying into an opportunity that wouldn't cost you $200,000 to go and create yourself. So like, we need to be clear as to what we are actually buying for the money. But I do think that, again, we have a written buy box. And it's like, okay, that's not to say that we have never bought something outside of that buy box, but they are guiding principles and there needs to be a very strong justification as to why, okay, if it doesn't fit one out of these nine things, why doesn't it? And what is the path to getting it to where it does conform to that?
Well, and just to be instructional to someone who's like never even considered it, you know, like maybe they've invested in real estate and they know what their cash on cash return is. Like, what is your buy box for businesses? What's an example of your nine things?
Sure. So we are pretty particular that we are looking to buy businesses from retiring owners. And I think that if somebody is selling a company and they're in their prime of life, like if they say, man, I'm 38 years old, I've had this thing for 5 years, it's great. It's the best company ever. This is why I'm selling it for a premium, on and on and on. You're going to make so much money. I always just ask myself, like, why are you selling it? And if you go to bizbuysell.com, which is just kind of the Zillow of business listings, 9 out of 10 times when they ask if it's being listed and they've answered this question, why are they selling? 9 out of 10 times it'll say pursuing other opportunities. And it's like, well, that always gives me pause that I'm like, if it's that great of a deal, why are you trying to get out of it? Okay. This is a person who would arguably be more passionate about it than anybody else on the basis. They started this thing. And they're ready to run for the hills. That causes me to be concerned. So I'm looking for a retiring owner. I think that that is the best case scenario. The other thing would be if they've had a massive life event. A lot of times it happens through illness. Their wife got really sick. They've been diagnosed with cancer. That can clearly change somebody's ability to work in something. So either one of those, I mean, clearly I don't want to see somebody have a debilitating illness, but that would be an exception to the retiring owner. I just want to know that there's a really strong justifiable reason to say this is a great company and they've got a logical reason to step away. And we're also looking for things that are low liability. The roofing company is actually an exception to that. Roofing is actually pretty high liability.
I was going to say roofing.
Yeah. People are fall, like, yeah, they make a mistake, they fall off a roof.
So. Yes. So that was an exception. And it's funny because we added that to our buy box after we bought the roofing company.
You learned. Yeah.
We learned. And we honestly, like, we haven't had big issues with people getting hurt. But still, if we had our Woods and Rathers, and if you really approach this with an abundance mind that said, I'm going to have more opportunities come my way than I will ever want to take action on. So therefore, it gives me the choice to be really picky about what I take on. If you believe that this opportunity that comes your way is the only end all be all, you'll never have this again, it changes the way that you're going to make decisions on that. And so we want low liability. We want customer funded. So what I mean by that is we have a company in Montgomery, Alabama that makes pool pavers. It's a manufacturing company. Before we ever ship out a pallet of pavers, that customer has paid for it. And so that customer is funding the progress versus us doing retaining wall company. And a lot of times those things are billed as a portion of completion. They're longer jobs. And so you're having to put out the money for your mobilization and your material cost and your labor before you ever get paid on that. So the best kinds of businesses to buy are customer-funded businesses where you're getting your money up front. Ideally, another thing that we would love to see in a business is we love recurring revenue. You know, if you sit there and say, part of the reason with our roofing company, we have maintenance contracts. That is just reoccurring revenue that I'm not having to go out, or my salespeople are not having to go out and sell a job in order to make money. A large majority of our revenue is through service contracts and just reoccurring stuff. So we like to see a lot of that. We also have some parameters around what we want their revenue to look like. And I will say, this is the one, whenever I'm talking to people about this, that I say, this is right. What's right for me may not be right for thee. Okay. And we didn't have this, and this is one of the ones we've added. We typically will not buy a business that has less than $3 million a year in revenue. Sorry, top line revenue. We do that because it's the concept of like selling a $300,000 house or selling a $3 million home. Your process may be similar to sell both, but the juice needs to be worth the squeeze. And if you realize, I think it's 95% of businesses in the U.S. make less than $1 million a year.
Yes.
You know, and so you're getting rid of a lot of opportunity by saying, man, we need it to actually be like generating some money. I talked to a guy yesterday who called me, and he's a real estate agent. He said, hey, I've got a client who's selling to coffee shops. He wants me to help him sell them. I'm looking at the numbers. Like, I think there's $150,000 a year after everything is paid. And he said, I'm questioning, like, what would you do in this situation? And I was like, how many transactions do you do a year? He's like, between 40 and 50. I said, I think $150,000 is a distraction from what you're currently doing. You could lever some things in your real estate business. If you needed to make another $150,000, I think you've got a really good foundation and platform with what you're already doing. I think you're taking on some unnecessary risk for not enough return on that. And the other concept was that one of the locations had only been in business for less than 2 years. The other one that he just started had only been open a quarter. They're a high rate of failure. There's high employee turnover. At that point, the seller, the owner, is working in the business, so he's going to have to pay somebody else to come in and manage that. That might be $70,000, so then it takes his profit down to $70,000 a year. I said, I wouldn't do it for $70,000 a year. I wouldn't do it for $150,000 a year. Now, that doesn't have to be the same litmus test if you're just getting started. Or I talk a lot about not being the primary operating business manager, company manager in what you're doing. However, if you're in a W-2, you're not making good money, you hate what you do, you just dread Monday morning rolling around. If you have an opportunity to buy into something and work in the business and make better money doing something that you're passionate about, there's nothing inherently wrong with working in the company that you own. That is not my model because I don't want to own one or two companies. I want to own 30, 40, or 50 companies. So therefore, I can't be the business operator. I just can't. But that's not to say that's not what everybody wants. And so there's nothing inherently wrong with working in it, but you need to be able to, if you want to scale your operations and say, I want to own multiple businesses, you've got to have a very clear path on how you exit. So when we buy companies, we're buying owner managed, and then we give ourselves 100 days of onboarding to get them professionally managed. So that is us looking at all the roles of the day-to-day that the owner has and saying, who do we need to hire or even promote from within? Who can take over these roles so that we can get out to where we're only working above the business? What that looks like is like we'll have level 10 meetings once a week with all of our company managers. And then we have a CFO that comes in to all of our companies once a month. And so he's closing out the month. He's looking at everything, making sure he would be the guy who's like, I think you're being embezzled. Yeah.
You know where all the bodies are buried.
Yes. The CFO is kind of your home inspector that comes in and just inspects everything on a monthly basis. And it's like, then we're meeting with him at the end of the month and being like, all right, these are the things you need to be concerned of. You're overbilled on this job. You're underbilled over here, that sort of thing. And so that's kind of what our management structure looks like. And then throughout the week, and again, this is more of my husband's role, but throughout the week, he's a coach and he's a mentor to his company managers, right? And so every once in a while, we'll get a call and just be like, man, I'm dealing with this HR issue. Like, what would you do? You know, and they know that they have tons of agency to make those decisions, but we're here if they need us, you know, and it's also the 80% rule and the fact that we've got great company managers. They still make decisions that we wouldn't make. Like, there's still all sorts of times that we're like, I would not have made that call. However, they have such care and concern for the business that we allow them to operate within, you know, for good, bad, and ugly. I mean, we would step in if there were massive things that were like, okay, that was a really bad call. That's going to cost us $200,000. There are lines that we would step in. But for the most part, we're content to let them run the companies as they see fit. They treat it like their own. It gives them a sense of agency and ownership. And I think that that's how you get people to stay. And we're not micromanagers by any means.
I love that. Okay, so you found a business, you know the kind of businesses that you want to buy, you found that opportunity through relationships. Like, how do people actually fund this? You know, like, how do you actually buy the business?
So that's kind of how long's a piece of string. The concept that we're in when we work with people buying residential real estate, unless you're super investor heavy, the majority of us are dealing with people who will fit in conforming loan boxes, right? Your VA, your FHA, your conventional loans. And we know what it is to go through and be like, oh man, I just met with this buyer. They're self-employed, but they've only been self-employed for 6 months. And I know that lender is going to want to see 2 years of history, right? So there's a bunch of boxes that people need to kind of conform into in order to be able to get these loans. The beautiful thing is whenever you're doing business acquisitions, there is very little government regulation unless you're getting an SBA loan. Okay, that is an option. But I could literally come to you and say, you know, Kimber, you want to sell this company. I have 5 donkeys, 3 chickens, and 2 buckets of apples. Would you trade me? There's nothing ever, there's no regulation keeping you from agreeing to do that. So it's literally just coming to terms that a buyer and seller can agree on. If you're getting an SBA loan, that gets a little different. SBA loans are great options for small business. You can get SBA loans with as little as 5% down. And so if you think about, hey, I've got $100,000, maybe I'll go buy a rental property, you know, well, that's probably going to require like 20% down. And so an SBA loan, you can get for as little as 5% down. And I will say also, we've never used an SBA loan. We have not had to, but we're very familiar with the process. We have considered it. They can be a bit of a beast to take down. There's a lot of red tape and bureaucracy around that. So it's not the easiest path forward. We have found a lot of our students, and we actually did this with a roofing company. When we needed a down payment for the roofing company, we pulled it out of our HELOC. That is honestly the easiest money to access. You know, no bank cares what you're using it for. If the value's there in your house and you can afford the payment, that's all they care about. And so we use that as a down payment for the roofing company. And then we got owner financing on that one. And we utilize owner financing quite a bit.
And just for people that maybe don't know, right, owner financing means that seller holds back a note, essentially, right, that you're then making a payment on over a term, a set period of time, to get them to that either valuation number or like the exit number, what's important to them. And to your point, Becky, about retiring people, there might be a reason from a tax standpoint, financial, where one lump sum cash event is actually not what they're looking for, right? They might be looking for over 5 years or 10 years, right, a payment that allows them to sustain their lifestyle. And that can be a win-win. So I think in that those early meetings, understanding like what's important to them it will give you great insight into how to structure that deal, which I thought was brilliant, right? You're using owner financing for a lot of these.
Right. And I would also say, we don't ever lead with owner financing. You know, most of the people who are sitting there thinking about selling their companies, they are thinking about, I'm going to go to the closing table and I'm going to have a one-time windfall. I'm going to get money. Especially, guys, if there's business brokers involved, it's very hard to have a conversation about owner financing because those brokers want to get paid. And typically, the way that they get paid is out of the proceeds of the sale. So if those proceeds don't show up on day one, they're kind of like, oh, well, what happens to me? So then they're whispering in the owner's ear, this is a bad deal and it's not what you want to do, you know? And so that is primarily the benefit to finding off-market properties or off-market businesses, rather, because business brokers are not involved and it's easier to negotiate those. And it's hard as a real estate agent. It's almost like I'm saying, don't use an agent. Like, I think in this situation, everybody is protected. We have attorneys, the sellers have attorneys. Like, it works a little differently than like in your typical real estate transaction. But when brokers aren't involved, when you just start down that path, Kimber, you made a great point. And that's something that as we're the first meeting, like sitting down and going to breakfast with this owner and his wife, we never talk numbers. Like those first initial meetings, you're just trying to build rapport. You're trying to figure out their story. You're honoring their legacy. You're figuring out like, what does a bad day at the office look like for you? And you should really pay attention to what they say in those moments, because their bad day at an office may be enough of a reason for you to say, dang, I don't think I'm as interested as what I think, you know, that I was. You know, what are some of the wins you've experienced over the last 30 years of being in business? Like, tell me about those early days, right? And so you're really building that rapport and you're not talking numbers. And then we kind of leave that meeting and then it's like, hey, you know, I think that there's enough here that we're interested in taking it to the next step. But, you know, obviously this needs to be a mutually agreeable, you know, next step. And so we kind of put the ball back in their court to just say, hey, you know, we would like to continue this conversation. I know that we've, you know, this is probably a new concept to you. Some of these people have only thought about selling for the last week because that's when their CPA or their insurance agent was like, hey, I know somebody, right? And so a lot of it is just like, it's a slow process and you've got to give people plenty of time and space. You're not going in there. A lot of what we use, if you're going to a listing appointment, you know, we've all been through the coaching that is just like, this is how you get the agreement signed when you're there. That is not how business acquisitions work. It is a slow roll.
And you should actually, right, Becky, be concerned if somebody's like, I need you to buy it tomorrow, right? Like that's actually, yes, for me, a big old red flag. Because your point about why is somebody wanting to sell? So if they're like, I need to sell by the end of the year, you want to understand what's going on, right? Is there a liability issue? Is there a financial issue? Is there some reason why it's like, it has to be done in this time frame? So like use those as like your spiny sense of like, what else is going on there?
And as we get further down and we are starting to talk more about, you know, numbers and stuff, we actually will put out on an Excel spreadsheet like an estimated tax savings over the course of, like you said, spreading it out 5 years, 10 years. We typically do like a 10-year amortization and then do a balloon payment in year 3 or 4 or 5 to where they know that, you know, in a handful of years, they're going to have all their money, but we'll do it over 10 years to keep the monthly payments a little lower. And then, you know, let's say year 4 rolls around and the company requires some sort of massive capital investment. And you're like, well, this money that we had set aside that the company, by the way, the company has funded this savings account. So now we've got this money. We could pay the seller off or we could replace all the equipment or whatever the situation may be. Just because your balloon payment is coming due in 12 months does not necessarily mean that you have to pay it off in 12 months. You can refinance it into a different vehicle. You may even have a conversation with the seller that simply says, hey, this is where we're at. We could pay you off now. These are some tax implications to that. How interested would you be in continuing to stretch this out for another 3 or 4 years? You can always renegotiate and have those conversations. Now, no part of that is not honoring what you said you would do. If the seller says, I'm not interested in that, then fine. You figure out a way to get him this money and you pay him off and that's that. But that's another reason that I feel like when owner financing is involved, these sellers are so motivated to make sure that this transition of power, if you will, is successful. When people still call them on occasion because they haven't talked to them in 2 years and they don't realize the company is sold, they are so honoring to us of like, man, I sold it. It's going great. You should call the office, blah, blah, blah. We still have some high profile clients that will only deal with the previous seller. And he's happy to take that call on occasion whenever, you know, and I think part of it, I'm like, yeah, I think it just makes him feel like, you know, something, he's got something to do.
Needed.
So it's going to feel needed. And so, you know, if you have that going on, like, that's cool, that's fine. But it does help that transition of them. You know, if you owe them a lot of money, they want to make sure you're successful. So owner financing has been a huge part in what we've done. Another cool way to finance businesses is like equity carve-outs. Right. If you're going through a company and you see that the company has a lot of equity, whether that's through real estate, whether that's through equipment, you could go through and essentially say, okay, is there a way for me to get to the closing table and then do a delayed down payment? Would the seller allow me to bring the down payment 30 or 45 days after the fact to where once I have those closing documents that show that I am now the owner, can I run right over to my bank and say I need to take out a line of credit against the building or I need to refinance some of this equipment? And then they end up giving you a check out of, you carve the equity out of the business to pay for the business. And that kind of stuff happens all the time. You could bring in partners. I have deals that I have no money in whatsoever because I found a partner who had the money, who wanted to be involved with what we were doing. And I'm like, great, you need to bring $150,000 and you're going to have 30% equity. You know, to where they bring that to the table. All we did was put the deal together. I bought two pieces of commercial real estate probably over the last 18 months. I would say it's probably close to $3 million. And I don't have any money in that. Like, I owned 30% of it, but it was like my roofing company needed a house and I needed a place to put it. And we went and found this, you know, this building that we're like, man, this looks great. We brought in an investor that is a mutual friend that buys a lot of residential property. And we just brought him in. We're like, David, you invest in tons of residential property. Like, that's not going super well right now. How would you feel about going into business with us and helping us out with some of these acquisitions for our buildings? And he did that. And he's done it on multiple places that we've bought. So there are so many ways. I feel like people have a tendency when they think about buying businesses to let money be their number one, objection, their number one factor of, like, I couldn't do that because I don't have $300,000 just sitting around. We always say there's a deal hierarchy. Number one, the top of the level is you've got to find a good deal. Number two, you need to find the person who's going to manage the deal or run the company. And then number three is money at the very bottom. I am thoroughly convinced anybody listening to this, if you found a good deal, you will find the money.
Yeah, I always say money finds good deals. Like, the harder thing to find is the good deal. So I think that it is, like, that hierarchy is so critical. Like, first, get the good deal. That also means you have to look at a lot of deals. I think your bizbuysell.com resource is a great one if you're just trying to get into this. Actually understand, like, what does a seller even put together? What should I ask for? It's a good place to just get started. You can look at your local area. It's like just a good place to start. You're likely not going to find the best deal on there because, like, they're opening up to the whole world. And there's likely, in most of those cases, business brokers involved. But at least starts to work the muscle. So you could actually, like, if you're in real estate, you kind of know when you walk in and it's a good deal. And so that skill is really critical. And then that who, I think, right, that leverage, who's going to actually operate the business if that's not going to be you. And I find in my buy box, right, Becky, if there's good operators in play, good people, I give a high value to the staff on the ground if they're going to be able to continue to operate and run the business really effectively. And I think that last piece of around capital, because you'll find the money.
Yep, I agree.
Okay, our time is almost up, but what I love the most, I mean, I love how passionate you are about this, Becky. For our listeners specifically, like, you are similar to a lot of them. You know, you've walked the real estate path, and now you're moving into, instead of investing in real estate, which a lot of people do, and is an amazing way to build wealth, you know, you're buying in Robert Kiyosaki's first asset category, which is businesses. And so I would love for us to just end with, like, what is your advice to someone who is thinking about this, wishing they could do this, you know, like, wanting to get started? What would you say to somebody?
First of all, I think so much of it revolves around mindset. And anybody who's been successful in the real estate business has been able to build something pretty much from nothing. And I think people underestimate their abilities. People under-index their abilities and resources, and they over-index their fears and challenges. And so I think it's super important that if they're thinking about doing this, you need to lean back on the, as Tony Robbins would say, you can't just float up here on a table. You need to build the legs. And so in building the legs, you need to look back at the challenges that you've overcame through the any businesses that you've been involved in before. You built a real estate business from nothing, and now you're selling $50, $60 million a year. Yeah, you're probably more than capable of doing this. You learned real estate when you knew nothing. You can learn this when you know nothing too. And so I feel like more, especially women, I feel like we under-index our abilities to just get in and figure stuff out. There are so many resources out there. There are so many people around you who are willing to help you. I'm a resource. We coach people how to do this. We teach people from start to finish exactly how to go through this process. There's support. We've got 60 people now in our program. And so it's really cool to just be in a community where everybody's moving in this goal to buy a business within 12 months. And we're not the only people out there who do this. You've got Cody Sanchez. You've got a lot of other strong women who are involved in doing this. But I think education is key, but I think action solves everything. Right. And so like some people just get into this like, I don't know enough. I don't know enough. I need to take another class. I need to read another book. Like, don't fly blind. Be careful, be cautious, but not fearful. I think you need to move forward with confidence and say, I figured out other things before when I didn't know what I was doing, and I will figure this out. I will also end by saying one of the first deal we ended up buying, I said the roofing company turned into our second deal because it took longer to buy. But the very first deal that we ended up buying was retaining wall company. We ended up overpaying for that business by $1 million. And if I would have allowed that to be the scar on my arm that every time I looked at and just said, man, I really made it. This was a bad mistake. It was, but I don't regret buying the company. And I don't regret the lessons that we learned through that process. And I've only gotten better since then. And now I'm passionate about helping other people make sure that they don't make the same mistakes that I did. But failure is never fatal if you don't quit. And we are all going to experience a journey along the way where we fail and you get back up and you fail forward, right? And that process of overpaying for my first company was a total fail forward moment. It doesn't define me. I don't live in shame or regret about that. I am grateful that I had that opportunity. That company pays me every month a day. I've got a great company manager. I don't plan to ever sell it. It is an income producing asset. Yeah, I overpaid for it. I took it on the chin. I learned something. It has kept me and helped, not only kept me from making the same mistake, but it's encouraged me to help other people not make the same mistake as well. So I just think the biggest thing is like, you can't live in fear. And if this is something that you want to do, there's plenty of people and resources available for you to get to that next step. And you're totally capable of doing this. It's not rocket science.
I love that. That is, I think, the perfect way to wrap us up, right? So that everyone can get out there and put these practices in place so that you are building big businesses, maybe multiple of them, ultimately to build that big life. So thank you so much, Becky.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Have a fabulous week.
Have a great week.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not KWRI and its affiliates, and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.